I think we ended up chapter 9, right? I believe. Chapter 8 was the first chapters were about visions that Zechariah had. And we learned that Zechariah was son of Berechiah, the son of Iddo the prophet. And it was in the second year of Darius, the king of Persia. And he has these visions. And then chapter 8, he tells them what they should do, kind of a practical reproof and, get going with stuff. Because they had come to build the temple and then they had stopped, and he and Haggai were sent there to get them going again. So in chapter 9, 1 through 8, verses 1 through 8 foretell of the future of the region and the places mentioned throughout the Old Testament. And chapter 9 and 10, we're going to read those, have to do with the coming of the Messiah. It says, "Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, thy king cometh unto thee. He is just and having salvation, lowly and riding upon an ass, and upon a colt, the foal of an ass." And I'm sure you're all familiar with how when Jesus Christ came to Jerusalem on Palm Sunday, so-called, he came riding on a white ass, right? Or a colt. And it says, "And I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall speak peace unto the heathen. And his dominion shall be from sea even to sea, and from river even to the ends of the earth." So that's a great prophecy of the coming Messiah. And then in verse 11 it says, "As for thee also, by the blood of thy covenant, I have sent forth thy prisoners out of the pit wherein is no water. Turn you to the stronghold. Ye prisoners of hope, even today do I declare that I will render double unto thee." And he's, telling these people who were captive, when he says, "I will render double," that means he will, fold over their accusations and sins, and they'll be free. "And when I have bent Judah for me, filled the bow with Ephraim, and raised up thy sons, O Zion, against thy sons, O Greece, and made thee as the sword of a mighty man. And the Lord shall be seen over them, and his arrow shall go forth as the lightning, and the Lord God shall blow the trumpet, and shall go with the whirlwind of the south. The Lord of hosts shall defend them, and they shall devour and subdue with sling stones, and they shall drink and make a noise as through wine, and they shall be filled like bowls and as the corners of the altar." And they had these, in the temple, they had these big basins that were up by the altar. That's what it's talking about there. And they were big, so he said, they'll be filled with wine. "And the Lord their God shall save them in the day, in that day, as the flock of his people, for they shall be as the stones of a crown lifted up as an ensign upon his land. For how great is his goodness, and how great is his beauty! Corn shall make the young men cheerful, and new wine the maids." So this is a prophecy of the future, but he's giving them encouragement, isn't he? And of course, some of it will happen, and then some of it still doesn't happen. So that's how it was. Chapter 10. "Ask ye of the Lord rain in the time of the latter rain, so the Lord shall make bright clouds and give them showers of rain to every one grass in the field. For the idols have spoken vanity, and the diviners have seen a lie, and have told false dreams. They comfort in vain. Therefore, they went their way as a flock. They were troubled because there was no shepherd. And he's talking about Israel. And why? What does it mean there was no shepherd? Well, the people that were supposed to be their shepherd, the priests, the spiritual leaders, the king, weren't doing what they're supposed to do. They led them away from God to idols. So the flock was like a sheep, or a flock of sheep. The people were like a flock of sheep without a shepherd, which means what? They get lost. They wander aimlessly. Mine anger was kindled against the shepherds, and I punished the goats, for the Lord of hosts hath visited his flock, the house of Judah, and hath made them as his goodly horse in the battle. Out of him came forth the corner, out of him the nail, out of him the battle bow, out of him every oppressor together. Okay, so let's go back to the first. The diviners, verse 2. Talks about diviners. Ding, ding. Diviners are fortune tellers, enchanters, ones that put themselves out there as being able to see future events. And there's different ways they did this. One way is called rhabdomancy. I don't know how you pronounce it. R-H-A-B-D-O-M-A-N-C. You can see it in Ezekiel 21. But it's where they throw sticks or arrows up into the air. And however they land and whatever, you know, way they're pointing and stuff, the diviner says that he understands and interprets future events from that. Sounds pretty wacky, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But next one is hepatoscopy. Hepatoscopy. Examination of a liver or other internal entrails of a sacrifice, you know, a sacrificed animal for guidance. So they would kill an animal and they would take the insides out and examine it, and then they would try to tell the future from this. What, you know, what does that liver mean? What does that kidney mean? Pretty crazy. Next one is teraphim. You can see this in 1 Samuel 15. Teraphim are, whenever you see I am on the end of a word, it's the plural in Hebrew. Teraphim, these are household gods revered and used for prognostication by the pre-exilic Hebrews, meaning before the exile. They had household gods and they would look to them for guidance. Necromancy, that's consultation with the dead, you know, dead spirits, supposedly spirits. We saw that with Saul went to the Witch of Endor, right? And she called up a ghost or a spirit that supposedly looked like the prophet Samuel. But that wasn't really Samuel, it was just a devil spirit. Okay. Next one is astrology, reading signs from the positions of the sun, moon, and planets in relation to the zodiac and to one another. And the zodiac, you know, is the sign, and I don't know how it all works, but people are still into it today. Hydromancy, forms and pictures that appear in water. Supposedly the gleam in the water induces a light trance, and the visions are subjective. Somebody looks in the water and they see the light bouncing off the ripples and so on and so forth, and they go into a trance and then they make prognostications. Very scientific. Okay. So anyway, that's the diviner. So So they were doing all this crazy stuff. And verse 3 again, God says, "Mine anger was kindled against the shepherds," you know, those people that were supposed to be leaders leading the people. "And the Lord of hosts hath visited the flock, his flock, the house of Judah, and hath made them as goodly horse, a goodly horse in the battle. Out of him came forth the corner, out of him the nail, out of him the battle bow, out of him every oppressor together." The corner, you know, out of Judah, this is what it's referring to. Out of Judah, out of him, out of Judah came forth the corner. That refers to the cornerstone. In Exodus 17, five and six. It says, "And the Lord said unto Moses, Go on before the people, and take with thee the elders of Israel, and thy rod wherewith thou hast smotest the river, take in thine hand and go. And behold, I will stand before thee there upon the rock in Horeb, and thou shalt smite the rock, and there shall come water out of it, that the people may drink. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel." And that rock was representative of what? Christ, yeah, Christ. And then we go to 1 Peter chapter 2 on the other end of the Bible. First Peter chapter 2 and verse 7. It says, "Unto you therefore which believe, he is precious. But unto them which be disobedient, the stone which was the builders disallowed, the same is made the head of the corner, and a stone of stumbling and a rock of offense, even to them which stumble at the word, being disobedient, whereunto also they were appointed." So the rock. Out of Judah would come a corner, a cornerstone. And that's, you know, Jesus Christ was what? Of the tribe of Judah. Out of him a nail. In Isaiah 22, too far. Isaiah 22. And verse 9, 22, verse 22. It says, "And the key of the house of David will I lay upon his shoulder, so he shall open, and none shall shut. And he shall shut, and none shall open. And I will fasten him as a nail in the sure place, and he shall be for a glorious throne to his father's house." Again, that's the Messiah, right? The Christ. The nail. And out of him the battle bow, which, you know, I don't really understand that, except that Jesus Christ will lead the battle and win the victory. Out of him every oppressor together. And they shall be as mighty men, which tread down their enemies in the mire of the streets in the battle. And they shall fight because the Lord is with them. And the riders on horses shall be confounded. And I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph, and I will bring them again to place them, for I have mercy upon them. And they shall be as though I had not cast them off, for I am the Lord their God, and will hear them. And they of Ephraim shall be like a mighty man, and their heart shall rejoice as though as through wine, yea, their children shall see it and be glad, and their heart shall rejoice in the Lord. I will hiss for them." That means I will call for them. It's kind of a strange Elizabethan word, I guess, in English. "I will hiss for them. I will call for them and gather them, for I have redeemed them, and they shall increase as they have increased. And I will sow them among the people, and they shall remember me in far countries, and they shall live with their children and turn again. I will bring them again also out of the land of Egypt and gather them out of Assyria, and I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon, and place shall not be found for them. And he shall pass through the sea with affliction, and shall smite the waves in the sea, and all the deeps of the river shall dry up, and the pride of Assyria shall be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart away, and I will strengthen them in the Lord, and they shall walk up and down in his name, saith the Lord. So, pretty great stuff. He's making some great promises to Israel, and you know, he's talking about tribes that got dispersed and wiped out, and you didn't hear from them for hundreds of years. You know, Ephraim and Joseph, and those, you know, you only heard about Judah and Benjamin and the Levites. So he did all those things. So let's see. I don't know how much more of this we want to read. 11 and 12 are really future events concerning the rejection of the Messiah and the result, and then the deliverance. So in chapter 12, let's read a little bit of that, I guess. The burden of the word of the Lord for Israel, saith the Lord, which stretcheth forth the heavens and layeth the foundation of the earth, and formeth the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, when they shall be in the siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. In that day, saith the Lord, I will smite every horse with astonishment, and his rider with madness. And I'll open mine eyes upon the house of Judah, and will smite every horse of the people with blindness. And the governors of Judah shall say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall be my strength in the Lord of hosts, their God. In that day will I make the governors of Judah like an hearth of fire among the wood, and like a torch of fire in a sheaf. And they shall devour all the people round about, on the right hand and on the left. And Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. The Lord also shall save the tents of Judah first, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem do not magnify themselves against Judah. In that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and he that is feeble among them at that day shall be as David, which was what? A great warrior, right? A great warrior and a great fighter, and you know, renowned for killing the giant. And the house of David shall be as God, as the angel of the Lord before them. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem. And I will pour out upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the spirit of grace and supplications. And they shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. In that day shall there be a great mourning in Jerusalem, as the mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the valley of Megiddon. And the land shall mourn, every family apart, the family of the house of David apart, and their wives apart, and the family of the house of Nathan apart, and their wives apart, and the family of the house of Levi apart, and so on and so on. Okay, so that's that. Now I'm going to read the last chapter, 14, from the NIV. And if you have an ESV or an NIV, you'll get it. If you have the King James, it might be a little more understanding. A day of the Lord is coming when your plunder will be divided among you. I will gather all the nations to Jerusalem to fight against it. The city will be captured, the houses ransacked, and the women raped. Half the city will go into exile, but the rest of the people will not be taken from the city. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. On that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, east of Jerusalem, and the Mount of Olives will be split into two from east to west, forming a great valley, with half the mountain moving north and half the mountain, or half, moving south. You will flee by my mountain valley, for it will extend to Azel, and you will flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him. Wow. You know, got to remember, Haggai and Zechariah were sent to talk to the people of Jerusalem there of the captivity that came back to build the temple, and they kind of got sidetracked. And he's given them this crazy, amazing revelation about the future. And it's just wild. Where did I leave off? Okay, verse 6. On that day there will be no light, no cold, nor frost. It will be a unique day without daytime or nighttime, a day known to the Lord. When evening comes, there will be light. On that day, living water will flow out from Jerusalem, half to the eastern sea and half to the western sea, in summer and in winter. The Lord will be king over the whole earth. On that day, there will be one Lord, and his name, the only name. The whole land from Geba to Rimmon, south to Jerusalem, will become like Arabah. But Jerusalem will be raised up and remain in its place, from the Benjamin gate to the site of the first gate to the corner gate, and from the tower of Hananil to the royal wine presses. It will be inhabited. Never again will it be destroyed. Jerusalem will be secure. You know, they had come back to what? A Jerusalem that was destroyed. Sure. You know, it had been flattened. The walls torn down, the gates burned, everything was ruined. It lay in waste. So he's saying it won't ever happen again. This is the plague with which the Lord will strike all the nations that fought against it, Jerusalem. Their flesh will rot while they are still standing on their feet. Their eyes will rot out of their sockets. Their tongues will rot in their mouths. On that day, men will be stricken by the Lord with great panic. Each man will seize the hand of another, and they will attack each other. Judah too will fight at Jerusalem. The wealth of all the surrounding nations will be collected, great quantities of gold and silver and clothing. A similar plague will strike the horses and the mules and the camels and donkeys and all the animals in those camps. Then the survivors from all the nations that have attacked Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, and to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. If any of the people of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, they will have no rain. If the Egyptian people do not go up and take part, they will have no rain. The Lord will bring on them the plague he inflicts on the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. This will be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. On that day, holy to the Lord will be inscribed on the bells of the horses, and the cooking pots in the Lord's house will be like sacred bowls in front of the altar. Every pot in Jerusalem and Judah will be holy to the Lord Almighty. And all who come to sacrifice and to take some of the pots and cook in them, and on that day, there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of the Lord Almighty. You know, Canaanites were not the good people. They were the bad guys. So that's Zechariah. Just, it's a lot of prophecies. It's a lot of figurative language and stuff. Now we're going to go back to Ezra. Back to Ezra, where we started all this. Chapter 5, we're going to read chapter 5 and chapter 6, and then who knows where we'll be. Is that rain outside?
Uh-huh.
Huh. Okay.
It's about time.
Yeah.
Was there a verse that we prayed for the rain?
Yeah.
Three verses.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, chapter 5, verse 1. We read this. This is how we went to Haggai and Zechariah. And then the prophets Haggai and prophet Zechariah, the prophets Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of God, the God of Israel, even unto them. Now, we're going to see as we go along, they prophesied more about more stuff than probably was written down. Because it says they prophesied and the people listened to them. So they prophesied unto the Jews that were in Judah and Jerusalem in the name of the God of Israel, even unto them. Then rose up Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Jeshua, the son of Jozadak, and began to build the house of God, which was at Jerusalem, and with them that were prophets of God helping them. So Haggai and Nehemiah were doing work. They weren't just sitting there, being spiritual. They were working with their hands. They were helping build the temple, which is pretty cool. At the same time came to them Tatnai, governor on this side of the river, and Shethar-Bosam and their companions, and said thus unto them, who both hath commanded you to build this house and to make up this wall? Then said we unto them after this manner, what are the names of the men that make this building? But the eye of their God was upon the elders of the Jews, that they could not cause them to cease, till the matter came to Darius, and then they returned answer by letter concerning this matter. The copy of the letter that Tatnai, the governor on this side of the river, and Shethar-Bozanai and his companions, and Apharsachites, which were on this side of the river, sent unto Darius the king. They sent a letter unto him, wherein was written thus unto Darius the king, all peace. So these guys, they didn't want the Jews to keep building the temple and getting ready to, restore the city and all this stuff. So they threatened them, and then, Haggai, they stopped and they started doing their own thing. And then Haggai and Nehemiah came and said, no, you can't quit. You're supposed to do this. God commanded this. So they start building again. So these guys write a letter to Darius. Be it known unto the king that we went into the province of Judea to the house of the great God, which is builded with great stones and timber, is laid in the walls, and this work goeth fast on and prospereth in their hands. Then asked we those elders, and said unto them thus, who commanded you to build this house and to make up these walls? We asked their names also to certify thee that we might write the names of the men that were the chief of them. And thus they returned us answer, saying, we are the servants of the God of heaven and earth, and build the house that was builded these many years ago, which a great God of Israel builded and set up. So there they have it, you know, and it was, that was Solomon, right? And but after that, our fathers had provoked the God of heaven and earth unto wrath, and he gave them into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, the Chaldean, who destroyed the house and carried the people away unto Babylon. But in the first year of Cyrus, the king of Babylon, the same king Cyrus made a decree to build the house of God. And the vessels also of gold and silver of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took out of the temple that was in Jerusalem and brought them into the temple of Babylon. Those did Cyrus the king take out of the temple of Babylon, and they were delivered unto those, to one whose name was Sheshbazzar, whom he made governor. And said unto him, take these vessels, go, carry them unto the temple that is in Jerusalem, and let the house of God be builded in his place. Then came the same Sheshbazzar, and laid the foundation of the house of God, which is in Jerusalem, and since that time, even until now, hath been in the building. Of course, there was a little, you know, delay there for a while. And yet it is not finished. Now therefore, if it seem good to the king, let there be a search made in the king's treasure house, which is there at Babylon, whether it be so. That decree was made of Cyrus, the king, to build the house of God at Jerusalem, and let the king send his pleasure to us concerning this matter. So remember, previously to this, there were other guys, and they threatened them and stopped them. And they got a letter from the king saying, stop the work, because they didn't know what was going on. So now these guys say, okay, they wrote Cyrus and they said, make a search, see what's going on. Was there really an order by Cyrus? And chapter 6. Then Darius the king made a decree, and search was made in the house of the rolls where the treasure were laid up in Babylon. And there was found at Achmetha in the palace, that is, in the province of the Medes, a roll, and therein was the record thus written. In the first year of Cyrus the king, the name Cyrus the king made a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. Let the house be builded, the place where they offered sacrifices, and let the foundation thereof be strongly laid, the height thereof 70 cubits, and the breadth thereof 70 cubits. So a score is 60, right?
20.
I mean 20. So 70 would be 60 cubits, which would be approximately 90 feet. It's a foot and a half. A cubit's a foot and a half. And so 70 by 70, so 90 feet by 90 feet. So it's a fairly large building, but not gigantic, you know.
For that time.
For that time, it was a big, big building, but they were bigger. With 3 rows of great stones and a row of new timber, let the expenses be given out of the king's house. So it even specified that the king's treasury was going to pay for the construction. And also let the golden and silver vessels of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took forth out of the temple, which is at Jerusalem, and brought them into Babylon, be restored and brought again unto the temple, which is at Jerusalem, every one to his place, and place them in the house of God. So this was written by Cyrus. Now remember, Cyrus back in Isaiah was prophesied of 175 years previously. And God called him the shepherd, his shepherd, and his anointed, which is the only Gentile ever up to this point that is said of. And he made this decree, and he's the one that decided to rebuild the temple. Down the road, Darius becomes in charge, And he doesn't know about it until these guys tell him. And so he looks up in the records and he finds out what's going on. Okay, let's see, where was he? Verse 6. Now therefore, Tatnai, governor beyond the river, that other guy, Sherathar Bosne, and your companions in Arphathite, whatever his name is, which are beyond the river, be far from thence. Let the work of the house of God alone, let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews build this house of God in his place. Moreover, I make a decree, what ye shall do to the elders of these Jews for the building of this house of God, that of the king's goods, even of the tributes beyond the river, forthwith expenses be given unto these men, that they be not hindered. And that which they have need of, both young bullocks and rams and lambs, for burnt offerings of the God of heaven, wheat, salt, wine, oil, according to the appointment of the priests which are at Jerusalem, let it be given them day by day without fail. Wow, that's a big turnaround there, isn't it? A big turnaround. So they did this. And verse 10 says, and they made offer, that they may offer sacrifices of sweet savors unto God, the God of heaven, and pray for the life of the king and of his sons. Also, I have made a decree that whosoever shall alter this word, let timber be pulled down from his house, and being set up, let him be hanged thereon, and let his house be made a dunghill for this. So anybody that messes with these guys, they're going to have a problem. You know, they're going to get hung, and then their house is going to be a dunghill. And that God hath caused his name to dwell there, destroy all kings and people, and that shall put to their hand to alter and to destroy the house of God, which is at Jerusalem, I, Darius, have made a decree, let it be done with speed. So he wanted it done, and he wanted it done quick. So it's pretty cool. Then Tatnal, the governor, on this side of the river, and Shethar Bosna and their companions, according to which Darius the king had sent, so they did speedily. They obeyed him. They weren't going to mess with Darius because he was the big poobah. And the elders, the Jews, builded, and they prospered through the prophesying of Haggai, the prophet, and Zechariah, the son of Iddo, and they built it and finished it according to the commandment of the God of Israel and according to the commandment of Cyrus and Darius and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. So these guys prospered through the prophesying of Haggai and Zechariah. So again, it would seem like, you know, they didn't just, the only thing they prophesied was these writings. But they were there prophesying, and these people prospered as they listened to the prophecies of what to do, and God gave them guidance. And it mentions Artaxerxes. There's a lot of names here, and it's a little confusing, but Artaxerxes seems to be more of a title, and it's what they call an appellative. It means the great king. So, in Persian, or whatever their language was, the great king. Verse 15, and this house was finished on the third day of the month Adar, which was the sixth year of the reign of Darius the king. Now, this whole book started in the second year of Darius. So, it took them 4 years once they started working to get it done, with a couple of interruptions. You know, because they had to get, you know, first they got threatened and they laid off. And then these other guys come and they get permission and they send to the king, and the king has to send back and say it's okay, which takes a little while because they didn't have email. They had snail mail in the real sense. They had camel mail. That's what they had. And the children of Israel, the priests and the Levites and the rest of the children of captivity, kept the dedication of the house of God with joy. And they offered at the dedication of this house of God 100 bullocks, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and for a sin offering for all Israel, 12 he-goats, according to the number of tribes of Israel. And they set the priests in their divisions, and the Levites in their courses for the service of God, which is at Jerusalem, as it is written in the book of Moses. Now, you remember, it says here the courses and so on. Remember, in Luke, it talked about Zacharias, the father of John the Baptist, and he was a priest of the course of Abia. That was one of the courses. So they had different names for these courses and stuff. And they every priest and Levite was, you know, was in a certain group, and they had certain functions and assignments. Okay. And it's all for the service of God, and so on and so forth. And the children of the captivity, verse 19, kept the Passover upon the 14th day of the first month. For the priests and the Levites were purified together, all of them were pure, and killed the Passover for all the children of the captivity, and for their brethren, the priest, and for themselves. And the children of Israel, which were come again out of captivity, and all such as had separated themselves unto them, from the filthiness of the heathen of the land to seek the Lord God of Israel, did eat, and kept the feast of unleavened bread 7 days with joy. For the Lord had made them joyful, and turned their heart, the heart of the king of Assyria, unto them, to strengthen their hands in the work of the house of God and the God of Israel. So that's the building of the house of Israel. Now we're going to jump to Nehemiah, which is the next book. We're going to come back to Ezra, but we're going to start Nehemiah. You didn't put my clock up there. Yeah, we might just keep going forever. So they kept the Passover, which was a pretty great thing. There we go. We've got 10 minutes. Okay, so they kept the Passover, which they hadn't done probably for a long time. So now we're going to get to Nehemiah. Now, the chronology of these books, they interweave. And actually, the first part of Nehemiah precedes what we read in Ezra up to that point. And Ezra wasn't there during that period, right? He wrote this, but he wasn't there, present at the time, physically. Okay? So now we're going to go to the book of Nehemiah. it says, the words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, and it came to pass in the month of Chislu, in the 20th year, as I was in Shushan, the palace. Shushan was the capital of ancient Persia, wasn't Babylon, but it, you know, they had, you know, there was Babylon, and that was the Chaldeans, and that's where Nebuchadnezzar was, and then the Persians came in and captured Nebuchadnezzar's grandson and took over, and they took over the empire. So they also had, you know, their own capital as well as Babylon. That Hanani, one of the brethren, came, he and certain men of Judah, and I asked them concerning the Jews that had escaped, which were left of the captivity, and concerning Jerusalem. And they said unto me, the remnant are left of the captivity there in the province are in great affliction and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem also is broken down, and the gates are burned with fire. So when it says they're in great affliction and reproach, it means that they're poverty stricken. They're in subjection to all the people around. They're not doing well, right? and the city of Jerusalem, the walls are destroyed, which means it's really not a city anymore because there's nothing there to protect them. So people aren't going to, you know, the reason that they lived in those cities was they had walls and they were protected from, you know, criminals and invaders and armies and whatever else. So, and the gates were burned with fire. And it came to pass when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned certain days and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. So this guy, Nehemiah, it doesn't tell us his background. But again, he must have been of the royal family from Jerusalem and Judah, because those are the guys that they took and they trained and they put in important places. And Nehemiah, as we're going to see, is in service to the king at this time. And he hears this of what's happening. The first thing he does is what? He prays, he fasts, he mourns, he gives his whole self to praying to God about this situation. You know, it's just not like he got up in the morning, he prayed and went to work. Mm-hmm. I mean, he put his whole heart into it. Mm-hmm. He fasted. He was, you know, all about it. Verse 4, and it came to pass when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned certain days and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven and said, I beseech thee, O Lord God of heaven, the great and terrible God, that keepeth covenant and mercy for them that love him and observe his commandments. Let thine ear now be attentive and thine eyes open, that thou mayest hear the prayer of thy servant, which I pray before thee now, day and night for the children of Israel, thy servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against thee, both I and my father's house have sinned. And you know, these men of God, we read Daniel's prayer for the captives that they could go back. And he reminds God of the prophecy of Jeremiah that he gave to Jeremiah saying 70 years would be the captivity. So here, this other guy is also praying for basically the same thing. And, you know, they both say we have sinned. They include, even though these guys are great guys, they believe God, they're doing their best, but they include themselves with the people. And men of God, real men of God, do that. They're not condescending. Mm. They're one of the people. They see themselves with everybody else. Mm-hmm. Okay? The only difference is they believe God. When God tells them to do something, they do it. And they're just committed and devoted. So he says, let thine ear, verse 6, now be attentive, and thine eyes open, that mayest hear the prayer of thy servant, which I pray before thee now, day and night for the children of Israel, thy servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against thee, both I and my father's house have sinned. We have dealt very corruptly against thee, and have not kept the commandments, nor the statutes, nor the judgments, which thou commandest thy servant Moses. You know, Moses comes up throughout the Bible, because he was the first guy that was called the man of God. He was the one that gave the law. He was the redeemer. And he was just, you know, he's the one that got it all going. And, you know, so he says, you know, we haven't obeyed what you told Moses to write down for us. Remember, I beseech thee, the word that thou commandest thy servant Moses, saying, if you transgress, I will scatter you abroad among the nations. But if you turn unto me and keep my commandments and do them, though there were of you cast out unto the uttermost part of heaven, yet I will gather them from thence and will bring them unto the place that I have chosen to set my name there. Now these are thy servants and thy people, whom thou hast redeemed by thy great power and by thy strong hand. O Lord, I beseech thee, let now thine ear be attentive to thy prayer, to the prayer of thy servant, and to the prayer of thy servants who desire to fear thy name and prosper. I pray thee, thy servant this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man, for I was the king's cupbearer. Mm. Okay? And this is a big deal, mm-hmm. because the cupbearer is the personal servant of the king. Right. Remember, there were two guys that got thrown in jail in Egypt with Joseph? One was the baker and one was the cupbearer. And the baker got hung, and the cupbearer remembered Joseph and said, oh, by the way, this guy can, you know, tell you what your dreams mean. And that's how Joseph got started. Well, here, this guy is a cupbearer. And a cupbearer was very important in the court and a very trusted servant. He was very trusted. And he would usually have a very close relationship with the king. So he says, and I was the king's cupbearer. That was a big deal. That was a big job. That was like being, the chief of staff at the White House for the president. Wow. You know, that's kind of what it was like. Chapter 2, we're not going to get through chapter 2, but I'm going to read you the first verse. And it came to pass in the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, the king, that wine was before him. And I took up the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I had not been before sad in his presence. Okay, Artaxerxes. I'm going to read you what Bullinger says about Artaxerxes. The word means the great king. It's an appellative, like pharaoh or czar or shah, something like that, you know. There were many pharaohs, there were many czars, okay? Used of several kings of Persia, synonymous with, I can't say the guy's name, Artaxerxes. Arta, meaning great, and Kshasta, meaning king, preserved in the modern Shah. This Artaxerxes was the great king Astyages. It's Astyages. Now, if you read secular histories, they have different names for the same guys in the Bible, because they go into these different records and they see when they lived and so on, and they, you know, can line it up. So Artaxerxes was a guy named Astyages, the husband of Esther, okay, and the father of Cyrus. How cool is that? And Esther and Mordecai apparently taught Cyrus. And that's why he made that decree to send and have the temple of God built. So I guess sometime or another we're going to have to read Esther. Okay. He was also Ahasuerus of Esther 1:1. His name in Esther is Ahasuerus. Again, it's some kind of title or something. Okay? So, and that means venerable king. He was also, it says some other stuff. So we're going to have to look at this more. It can be a little confusing. But that's where we're going to stop tonight. And so Nehemiah is the cupbearer, and Artaxerxes is the king. And so this precedes Cyrus and Darius, okay? And then, you know, we'll catch up, and then at some point we'll go back to Ezra, because they coincide. And then Nehemiah and Ezra are together, along with Haggai and Nehemiah, as they help the people and establish the kingdom once again. Okay? Mm-hmm. It took all those men of God to get them back. You know, pretty amazing.